ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन
ॐ नमो भगवते
वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयम् उदीरये ततो जयम् उदीरये. This is our very means of conquest. To be able to have the facility we have now is quite extraordinary. It's the mercy of Krishna through the parampara. I may take it for granted that I have this configuration, the altar of Shishi Radha Madan Mohan, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Shishi Lakshmana Shingare Panchatattva. We have our acharya, we have space to hear and chant and so forth. But actually this is a very specific arrangement that has been passed down to us from Krishna through the parampara and designed. And with such an arrangement, one can, by participating in hearing and chanting about Krishna, one can cross over the ocean of material existence, which Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita is formidable. Daivihyeshu gunamayi mama maya duratyaya mamevye prapadyante mayametam tarantite. That this material nature is very difficult to overcome. And furthermore, in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, Mamshayo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunayan samatityaitam brahmabhuya yakopate. The means to rise above it is, well, first of all, to surrender to Krishna. And then the means of surrender is to organize one's life to accept things that are favorable, to reject things that are unfavorable, to develop a dependence on Krishna as one's maintainer and as one's protector, to always be very humble, and to consider that everything that I have, including myself, belongs to Krishna. And everything that is achievable can be achieved through the process of bhakti. This is called the faith. Shraddha shadde vishwas kahe sudri dhanashtray Krishna bhakti kore sarva karma krita hoy. When I have an ever-increasing understanding that by performing bhakti, all other duties are done and everything that's achievable can be achieved, this is called shraddha, or faith. And this is confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Devarshi Bhutatman Hridam Pitranam Nakinkara Nayam Mrini Charajam Sarvatmanaya Sharanam Sharanyam Gato Mukundam Prihritakartam. That if one is in the surrendering process to Mukunda, then all of one's obligations to other entities are covered. I was going to say nullified, but I like covered better. Krishna covers it all. He writes a big check. You don't have to worry about the other things. So it's befitting that we're here, gathered in this place. It's what the sages at Naimasarnya, how they attain perfection by meeting Suta Goswami there. It's how the sages who sat to hear Shukadeva Goswami, even though he was a 16-year-old, and many of them were hundreds of years old, and great venerable sages sat to hear the Bhagavatam out of reverence, because tato jayam udirayat, it's the very means of conquest. And those of you here at ISV and elsewhere who are tuned in from around the world, who are regularly reading Srimad Bhagavatam, know that Srimad Bhagavatam is the answer to all questions. It answers all questions, and it also does so in a way that is uncanny. It addresses all the psychological conditions of a human being and shows how to overcome the obstacles created by those psychological conditions, which are a result of one's interaction with the three modes of material nature, and to come to full faith in Krishna, which is not an easy thing to do when the living entity is ensconced in the material energy, how to pull them out. In fact, I was just discussing even last night with some devotees who are taking care of other devotees, which is a worthy occupation, that we were remembering how Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that I hope that all my disciples are prepared to give at least 200 gallons of blood to save even one person from the mire of material existence. And so we should consider that leaving the material nature is formidable. It's not something that can be done as a hobby. One has to invest one's life and soul. As Prabhupada says, in the light of the Bhagavad, going back to Godhead is not a plaything. It is, it must be taken very seriously. On the other side, the acharyas have lined up the process in such a streamlined way that ordinary people can take advantage of the system. You don't have to become a great sage and move to the mountains. You don't have to move to Mount Diablo and camp out in a cave. They're probably all closed now because of the government shutdown anyway. But anyway, in any case, anybody living in Silicon Valley and working at the same time can achieve perfection because of the potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead coming down through His pure devotees. As mentioned, Bhagavatam, to confirm my point, Kirato Hunandra Pulinda Purkasha Abhirashumba Yavana Kasadaya Yini Chapapa Yada Pasha Yashaya Shudyanti Tasmaya Pravivishnavi Namaha. Shukadeva Goswami says that there are, he names categories of people who are below ordinary. They're not considered ordinary because they're outside the Varnashram system. They're unregulated and do crazy stuff. But even they, he says, through this process, of the Bhagavat process, can be fully liberated and come to the professional stage of life. So, congratulations for coming here today to this sacred place and for joining us online from places around the world. So first we'll chant the Mangal Charm. Om Jnana Timurandasya. I'll start lower. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurum Lilitam Dina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadahmayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Suta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvetam Sarvajutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shivishakambitamscha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamani Hari Priye Vansha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gaura Bhakta Vinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Gopremanande, Hare Hare Go. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 8th canto, we find that Bali Maharaj, who's actually the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, had conquered the heavenly kingdom. The demons went up into the heavenly region and they observed the beauty of heaven and saw Indra and all his minions there engaged in their daily activities, which are pretty nice because it's heaven. And then they took it over and the demigods all had to leave. And this may seem quite surprising, but the Bhagavatam points out to us again and again what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Punar Avartina Vajana Amapetya Tukantaya Punar Janma Navidyate. That the material world is a place of suffering from the topmost planet, Brahmaloka, down to the lowest, Patala. And no matter what kind of condition one thinks is nice here in the material world, it's actually an illusory type of nice because it's not our home and we'll be moved around. Recently, when I was along the California coast, I saw how many people had purchased prime property right along the coast, the headlands, the California coast, beautiful views of the ocean, and invested millions of dollars in building homes. And as I see the homes and then look down at the ocean and how the ocean had, over time, probably hundreds, maybe thousands of years, worn holes in the huge masses of rock below. So there are actual channels that go through from the relentless pounding of the waves. And then I was comparing in my mind the time scale of the people living in the homes to the ocean and the forces of nature. And in geological time, our lives are but a flicker, a flash. And 7 years, 8 years, if one's lucky, goes by in the blink of an eye. And time moves on inexorably. However, everyone's thinking that I have some important things to do here, and I'm an important person. But not only is our life tenuous here, but it's rather insignificant as well, unless one's engaged in the process of devotional service, as is mentioned in the Bhagavatam, Ayur Harati Vai Pum Sun, that the sun is crossing over the sky and it's telling everybody, you're wasting your time. Unless you're hearing and chanting, you're actually just burning yourself out in the few seconds that you have to take advantage of this life. And this is true not only on this earth planet where we have a modicum of happiness and success. It's kind of a blessing actually because we're right in the middle. But in the heavenly planets where things are perfectly aligned, not perfectly as I'm saying, but they're aligned in such a way that one feels kind of way you do when you have enough money for the foreseeable future, the weather is good, and your refrigerator is full, and you don't have any worries at the moment. In heaven, things are like that all the time. So people tend to forget about self-realization. In any case, it's as good as it gets in the material world, practically. And normally, those places are reserved for people in the mode of goodness. However, here in the 8th canto, we find that the demons usurp that region, and Bali Maharaj and his companions move into heaven, and Indra has to leave. One of the great lessons we find from this section of the Bhagavatam is that there's a certain ordered way that the universe works. One of them is that a in order to keep your position here, you have to work really hard. Evidence? When the demons move into heaven, the Brahmins, headed by Shukracharya, his spiritual master, advised him that he must perform at least 100 Ashwamedha yajnas. That's very expensive. It's not like the kind of yajnas we do here, you know, with a couple of spoonfuls of ghee. You have to spend a lot of money and time and energy and so forth. And it's a big deal. So the reason they had to do that is to keep their frequent flyer status. As everyone knows who flies, it's something you have to keep up on, otherwise they forget about you really quickly. On the airlines, you have to have fly a certain amount of miles so you can walk on a little plastic red carpet and say, okay, you go here and everybody else wait your turn. So the demigods, when they first got to heaven, started doing yajnas. Why? Because in order to stay there, they had to pay the rent. They had to have enough sukriti to stay up there. So that's one thing about the material world that's constantly nagging us, is maintaining our status, whatever it may be. And the moment you take your eye off your status and you just let things go to default mode, everything starts to degrade through the process of entropy. That happens on a psychic level, it happens on a physical level. And this is troublesome. The material world drags us down. So Bhagavatam's saying that this isn't our natural environment. And just see, even if you make it to a beautiful place where everything looks to be trouble-free and convenient, you won't be able to keep it. So don't try so hard for that. Narada Muni says, Tasyaiva heta, Tasyaiva heta prayate tako vido, malabhite yad brahmatam uparita, talabhite dukabaranyata sukham sarvatra, kalena sarvatra kabhira ramasa, which means that, don't invest your time in trying to find a convenient, nice situation in the material world, because it just won't happen. As over time, it'll be eroded and taken away from you. And we don't like that as living entities, because we're eternal. And he says, however, do take your time to secure your position spiritually. Do purely spiritual practices in order to establish yourself in the plane of anishta. You have a standing in the spiritual world. You have a portfolio to show, a spiritual portfolio. You have a spiritual reputation. You have a spiritual integrity inside yourself, because you know that you've struggled and you've overcome the various obstacles that have faced you, and you've taken shelter of the scripture and association, and therefore you've come to the point of nishta, or platform where you can stand on your own 2 feet. So do try for that with great enthusiasm. So that's one lesson that we get from this chapter. The other is that anything can happen in the material world. It's really surprising to the demigods that all of a sudden the demons show up. You know, knock, 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 get out. And they have the power to do it. And we find this politically, you know, people think everything, we got everything secured, and then there's some upheaval. All over the world now, there are ways in which people are commenting about how various extreme religious and political ideologists are taking over posts that were before reserved for people who were more progressive and so forth. But this upheaval is always going on in the material world. This is one of the points the Bhagavatam makes. Don't think that you can find equilibrium here and it'll just rest. It won't, because the modes are always competing for supremacy. And we heard in the 7th canto how Hiranyakashipu took over everything. And it's pointed out in the Bhagavatam, in the 7th canto, that this can happen. It doesn't matter where you put your house. Somebody else is going to move in and wreck your whole program sooner or later, or a flood will come, whatever. But Hirani Kashipu took over even the heavenly planets, even the positions of the demigods and so forth. So this is the way the material world moves. So don't try to get comfortable here, because the modes can shift and they pervade the whole material world. And how did the demigods lose their position, and how did the demons become so strong? This is another very interesting point. The answer is through improper alignment and through proper alignment. The demigods lose their power because they weren't properly aligned with their spiritual master, Brihaspati. Indra is sitting in his assembly, and he's starting to get used to being worshipped by everybody. They're singing his praises, people are fanning him, giving him gifts, bringing him nice drinks, and then his spiritual master walks in, and Indra thinks, well, I bowed to him last time, so this time, you know, just pass on it. Besides, you know, these people are worshipping me now. And so Brihaspati can understand the mentality of Indra. And he didn't say anything, he just turned around and walked out and disappeared completely. And that's really hard when that happens, because then Indra came to his senses and realized, oh, I think I made an offense. He ran after his spiritual master, but he was gone. And after that, Indra and the demigods lost their potency. Meanwhile, the demons were aligned with Shukracharya. Now, he's a family priest. In other words, he's not considered to be the topmost of spiritual masters, because he's a functionary in some ways, helping the demons to achieve their material desires and so forth. And he also has his desires. He's getting paid by them, basically. Nonetheless, because the demons were aligned with him properly and worshiping him, they had potency and power. It's a very interesting point, just about alignment itself. We sing Yasya Prasada, Bhagavat Prasada, Yasya Prasada, Nagati Kutopi, Jayam Stuvam Stasya Yasas Trisandhyam, Vande Guru Sri Charanaravindam. There's a way in which Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur writes in this prayer, if you're properly aligned in spiritual life through the super succession, through your guru, you're a servant of the servant, you're pleasing your guru, then the blessings will be flowing through. And if you lose that connection, then very quickly you'll find that you lose your potency. So those are a couple of lessons from that chapter, but it's leading up to the Pyavrata vow that I want to bring up in just a minute. But first we'll take a couple of reflections. For instance, how are you doing? And anything that you heard so far that you want to reflect back. Shraddha, yellow mic, please. Thank you.
I really liked your comment about the alignment and how we align it, to be aligned with the right place, and especially to be aligned in the right way with your spiritual master. And Indra didn't do that, and that's why he suffered so much. I was also thinking about how other alignments are also important, like if the wheels of the car are not aligned, then it gives you a lot of grief when you're driving.
Yeah, alignment leads to happiness. Yes. Radha Krishna Prabhu.
On alignment, I was just thinking that one always started developing their own energy as one grows with the maturity and thinks maybe this is the proper alignment. As one takes shelter, I think it is very critical to ensure that, as you mentioned, that blessings will only flow if you're properly aligned with your spiritual master. And these examples also tell you that even Indra was as a, such an exalted position, is so close to Vishnu's mercy, but as he started not aligning, he could lose that. And what can happen to those who are living in this material world who has like no intelligence at all? So
yes, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when speaking to Prakashananda Saraswati, says that I, before my spiritual master, am a fool, murka. Although Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and even if you look at him as a, in the context of him being a person who was born in Navadvipa and so forth, even if you took him as an ordinary person, he was extraordinary in all ways, as the greatest of all scholars, defeated the Digvijay Pandit and so forth. But when he came before Srila Ishvara Puri, he claimed himself to be a fool and was open for instruction. Similarly, Rupa and Sanatana Goswami, who could write poetry backwards and forwards and knew many, many languages, were the most intelligent of their time. And they came before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, said that we're so foolish that we actually think we know something. We don't know anything. Please tell us. And this is one of the ways in which Krishna describes in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, one opens oneself for perfect alignment in knowledge, aman dhamma dhamma dhamma, that one considers oneself to be empty and ready to be filled up through instruction, through the disciplic succession, not coming with any extra ideas of one's own, but ready to submit to the higher authority. One should use one's doubting process to come to the point of accepting that there is a supreme authority, and one should investigate very carefully. It's not something that is done sentimentally, but one should use one's intelligence to understand the fact that there is axiomatic truth. And if there is a supreme personality of Godhead, and he's benevolent, he'll want us to know about him, and therefore he'll make a channel available so that we can know him. And if one can investigate the process of knowledge, how it comes down, the fact that there is an absolute truth, and surrenders to that, then one will be perfectly aligned. Yomam eva masambhudo janati purushottamam sasarvavid bhajatinam sarvabhavina bharata. And when one comes to the conclusion that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead and takes shelter there, then one becomes perfectly situated in knowledge. What are the things? Yes, Amit Prabhu.
Krishna Prabhuji. Krishna Prabhuji.
That mic needs to go up a little bit, please. Go ahead, try it again.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. So I think the way you started, Prabhuji, that there is no equilibrium. So material modes are always contesting to kind of tip the balance. And to survive that contest, I think the key point is staying properly aligned. And there is something that you said in Wednesday's class that's still lingering in my head, is that, you know, how do you, if you are working to project yourself versus pleasing Krishna, you will always get into the entanglement of the material moods. And so it was said in the context of the cooperation, but again, if you think from a context of properly aligned, so the alignment is we are not trying to work to project ourselves, whatever be the circumstances are, but we are trying to work to please the to please Krishna or the representative of Krishna, which is the spiritual master. That keeps you properly aligned, and then you can survive this contest between the material nature, material modes, to maintain the equilibrium. If not maintain, at least stay away from the impact of changes of equilibrium. That's something is something I thought was very important for me.
Yes, it is. One of the points of surrender is this sense of doing selfless service. I'm not doing it for my own aggrandizement, but I'm doing it because that's my position. When Prahlad Maharaj was offered many benedictions by Lord Nrsimhadev, he said, I'm not a merchant, I'm not a vanik. Please don't ask me to take something, because I didn't serve you because I want something in return. I'm your servant, you're my master. That's eternal, that's our position, so I just serve you. And this is the basic standard of pure devotional service, that one must do selfless service in order to be perfectly aligned.
Savai pumsam paro dharmo yato bhakti radhoksaje ahaitukiya pratyata yatma supersediti.
There's no other way to be happy except for giving up one's personal motivations and serving. So even if one is doing devotional service but has some personal motivation, one may not feel satisfied. What are the things? Kishore Sham, welcome. You get the driving the longest distance award.
It's a beautiful drive at 5 in the morning. I think it's a really profound point, which you mentioned pretty quickly in passing, but the living entity's dislike for entropy is being evidence for our eternal nature. I've kind of been, I didn't get much past there. I was really thinking, pondering that particular point.
It's a point Prabhupada brings up in the second canto of the Bhagavatam when he talks about frustration. And he said this is evidence of the soul's eternality. Otherwise, if we were the same as material nature, what would we'd be frustrated with? But because the ends never quite meet here in the material world, no matter what you do, it's kind of like, hey, come on. And what to speak of the impermanence factor, which is constantly vexing us. This is proof that the soul, which is witnessing all these things, is a superior entity and is eternal. So this is an impetus for us to remember that we're not part of the material world also, he says in that purport in the Bhagavatam. When we're contemplating self-realization, he says a process that can be done by even an ordinary person. And looking inside, you should notice your frustration and realize that that's because you don't belong here. That's good news. It's actually only because I expect to be happy that I feel frustrated. If I'm not expecting it, and I take Krishna's words as they are, that there's no happy place in the material world, then I won't be so disappointed at all, because, hey, after all, it is what it is. If I invest myself in it and think, no, if I just adjust it a little bit more, and actually Krishna didn't really mean that, it means it for some people, not for me, then I'll constantly be struggling with the material nature. If you don't have anything, you don't have anything to lose, right? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. One reflection came from my mind, from Ramayana, and regarding this alignment and non-alignment. So, jaha sumati saha sampati nana, jaha kumati maha vipatti nidana. Means that when Ravana is not listening to Vibhishan, it's like non-aligned, so he lost the battle. And even Ram is that where there is a bhunkis and reach, everybody is aligned, so he won the battle. So it's alignment and non-alignment, one of the things he came in my mind.
Yep. So this is the formula for success. If you align yourself with Krishna through the disciplic succession, then you'll be successful.
Hare Krishna. The same alignment point. Where you said that when Indra was disrespectful, he lost the potency. So it's a big lesson to all of us not to take our spiritual master for granted. Just because we think we are doing good, we have to realize that it's the potency of the spiritual master and ultimately Krishna that has empowered to do what we are doing. And we need to always keep that in mind, that never take it for granted what we have today. That's an important lesson for me.
Yeah, and in one of the verses of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu warns against what he calls a hati mata, or a mad elephant offense. He describes how upadi vichindi tatra, I can't remember the Bengali right now, that when a mad elephant gets into your garden, he or she will ruin it, and very easily. So in a similar way, if one offends a Vaishnava, then one can ruin one's devotional progress. And Prabhupada talks in the purport about how disobeying the orders of the spiritual master is an offense. So this means coming out of alignment. One begins to drift away and think it's not important, or develop an attitude of laxity and so forth. And this can cause a misalignment and havoc, actually. I just read something recently where Prabhupada said that even someone who's very spiritually advanced, if they disregard the process and make bad decisions, they can put themselves in a really difficult situation. So he was advocating that we be careful and remember the fortune that we have, and remember to stay aligned. There's a tendency often in many disciplines, as soon as one becomes advanced, to start thinking that I don't have to follow as much. But the admonition is given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that even when one is in a very advanced situation in devotional service, externally one should still perform the rules and regulations meticulously, at least for the example that it sets for others. So again, the alignment is important, yes. Yes, Shraddha. From the internet.
So Bhaktin Kamala Vasant is watching, and she really liked the term spiritual portfolio.
Yes, spiritual portfolios.
And she also says that, I think alignment is the big thing today, trending today. So she was saying that that without alignment with the spiritual master, blessings will not flow. And we have Radha Venkat Prabhu from Folsom, and he's saying that Bhagavad Gita 18.58 also talks about alignment. That alignment with Krishna, doing things with...
Well, we're going to have to take a look at it now, right? 1858, please.
1858.
Yes, and the spiritual portfolio, we also talked in one discussion we had about a spiritual resume. When you're developing your resume, normally you look at it carefully, what are your references, and I don't know what's in a resume, I've never made one, to be honest with you, but we have to have also a spiritual resume. What do we present when we're applying for a permanent position in devotional service? It's like, who have you worked for so far? Even when you're getting ready for college, you need references, right? You have to have reference letters, and you have to show that you've kind of gone out of your way to be part of different clubs and done service and things like that. So similarly, yeah, it's part of our portfolio. It actually makes a difference. This is mentioned in the Sri Upanishad, right? We'll hear from our pundit circle down here which verse I'm thinking about. Consult amongst yourselves. Verse starts with a V. You know the verse. Yeah, just say it in the mic. Be a little assertive, please.
Vayu anilam amritam atedam pashmantam sharyam om kritosmara kritam smara kritosmara kritam smara.
Very, very good. Now give it to your brother and he'll explain why I picked that verse. You don't have to give the exact English translation, but in the context of what I was saying, what does that mean? And by the way, I was talking about resumes and portfolios, and it matters what you have to present. Let this temporary body be burned to ashes, and let the air of life be nourished with the totality of air. Now, O my Lord, please remember what? Well,
Please remember all
my sacrifices.
All my sacrifices that I've.
Because you are the ultimate beneficiary. Please remember my resume. Please remember all I've done for you. Because Prabhupada writes in the purport, you don't have to remind Krishna, he already knows what you've done. But is that some kind of evidence for the context of having a resume? Right? Agreement? Consensus? Thank you. Okay. Shraddha?
So Yashoda Kripa Prabhu is holding the fort alone in the kitchen today. So he's texted me his reflection.
Oh, please.
So he's saying that Brihaspati was a functionary guru and not a Vaishnava devotee spiritual master. So there's a tendency in people to believe any religious person as a guru, which may not be necessarily in the disciplic succession. So we have to respect everyone, but be careful with who is not a genuine Vaishnava guru.
Yes. And this comes up in the pastime of Bali Maharaj, because Bali Maharaj had decided to surrender to Vishnu, and then Vishnu came to him in the form of a little dwarf Brahmin, who incidentally is mentioned in the Lagabhagavatamrita as one of the most beautiful of the incarnations of the Lord, a little brahmachari holding the pot and the stick. It's like, just want 3 paces of land. He's like, come on, ask for more. So that's okay. Satisfied. Oh, well, Bali's his namesake is here, so he wants to say something.
I think in alignment there are two instances based on the scripture. One is when Baladev Vidyabhushan started writing Govinda Bhashya. It was also 3 things he took in consideration. The first one is receiving the mercy of God, which is Govinda, receiving the mercy of the Guru, and receiving the mercy of the Vaishnava's community. Because 3 combined together, then only he confirmed the flower fail, and then he confirmed that this is what Vaishnava's Gurus and Krishna, 3 of them, wants complete alignment. And the second instance also, similar to the how the Shastra is important, when Ballabhacharya, when he petitions to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu about some of his scriptures and it is not in conjunction with Sridhar Swami, then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave very heavy statement. Sridhar Janamani, Vaishya Paramani. Means whoever doesn't consider Sridhar as my authority, I consider him a prostitute. Means such a heavy statement, so one must be aligned with the Guru Parampara, aligned with the previous Acharyas, that is important.
Thank you for giving such excellent examples to emphasize that. And when Bali Maharaj saw Vamandev, he wanted to surrender, but Shukracharya advised him not to. In fact, Bali had promised to give the 3 paces of land. And then Shukracharya told him that you're actually about to be cheated, because this is Vishnu, and with the first 2 steps he's going to cover everything, and then what will you do? And even knowing that, Bali said, well, if it's Vishnu, I should give it. And also, nobody in my family has ever lied or taken back charity, so I should do it. And Shukracharya cursed his disciple, said, I curse you to lose everything. But he was actually angry at him. The reason was because there was something in it for him. In other words, how is Shukracharya going to get Dakshina if his star disciple was now a Vaishnava and under, you know, siege and everything was taken from them? So Prabhupada points this out, that this is not the right mentality, not proper alignment with the duty of being a spiritual master. The duty of the spiritual master is to advise everyone to surrender to Krishna. As Krishna says himself in the Bhagavad Gita, Sarvadharmam Parityaja. So it's easy enough to get out of alignment by presenting the wrong vow And if one's in the post of a spiritual master, one has to represent Krishna properly. So this verse was recommended to us by Radhakrishna Prabhu? Oh, Radha Venkat, okay. And here it is, Machita Sarvadurgani Matprasada Tarishasi Atacha Tvam Ahamkaram Nashurkshasi Vimungshasi. And the translation is, if you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. Purport. A person of full Krishna consciousness is not unduly anxious about executing the duties of his existence. Not unduly anxious. The foolish cannot understand this great freedom from all anxiety. For one who acts in Krishna consciousness, Lord Krishna becomes the most intimate friend. He always looks after his friend's comfort, and he gives himself to his friend, who is so devotedly engaged working 24 hours a day to please the Lord. Therefore, no one should be carried away by the false ego of the bodily concept of life. One should not falsely think himself independent of the laws of material nature or free to act. He is already under strict material laws. But as soon as he acts in Krishna consciousness, he is liberated, free from the material perplexities. But as soon as he acts in Krishna consciousness, he is liberated, free from the material perplexities. One should note very carefully that one who is not active in Krishna consciousness is losing himself in the material whirlpool in the ocean of birth and death. No conditioned soul actually knows what is to be done and what is not to be done. Right, a person who acts in Krishna consciousness is free to act because everything is prompted by Krishna from within and confirmed by the spiritual master. So let's go back to the top of the purport. Is a person in full Krishna consciousness not unduly anxious about executing the duties of his existence? Doesn't mean you don't execute the duties of your existence, but you're not unduly anxious about them. It's confirmed by Prahlad Maharaj in his prayers to Lord Nrsimhadev when he says that a boiling water can't save a drowning man, that parents can't save their children, and that medicine can't save a sick patient unless the Lord authorizes it. And this should be the consideration, even as one's doing one's duty, that it won't be successful unless Krishna gives his blessing. And that's something that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to mark by saying Krishna willing. In other words, we say we're going now to the town, Krishna willing. We'll just be there in 5 minutes, Krishna willing. Being aware of the fact that I'm not independent in my movements here in the world or for the outcomes of anything is one of the most basic and important aspects of Krishna consciousness. One should remain conscious of me always in that way. And I really like the second line, the foolish cannot understand this great freedom from all anxiety. And that's the only way to actually become free from anxiety, is to become freed from claiming that one's the doer. And if one accepts the fact that one's completely dependent on Krishna, then there's a kind of freedom that nobody else can achieve through arranging the material nature in a certain way. Any other comments about the purport? Yes. Please.
I have a comment about just what we heard today. We heard Tato Jayam Udiriyat means is the means of conquest. So that was kind of a revelation that by performing kirtan, you know, you connect with bhakti, and then you define faith, which is everything that we have belongs to Krishna, and then everything that we need can be attained by through bhakti. So that kinds of sums it up. I have a question. That you talked about nishtha, so nishtha is a result of constant practice, or it's a result of blessings from Krishna, or it is a result of thickening of faith.
Or what is the third thing?
Thickening of faith by practice.
All three.
It is considered the thickening of faith. Yadrishi, yadrishi, shraddha, siddhir, bhavati, tadrishi, Brahma Samhita says that as one's faith thickens, one is known to be more advanced in devotional service. And actually the progression of stages of devotional service in which nishtha is mentioned, starting with adau shraddha, tata sarvasangata, bhajana kriya, tatonata nivriti set taton nishta ruchi stata. This mention of ruchi comes in the line of progressive stages of thickening of faith. And it begins, of course, with agyata sukriti. One comes in contact with devotees unknowingly and then comes to the point of some awakening of a feeling of appreciation for devotional service, which leads one to association with devotees, which leads one to practicing devotional service, which leads one to the process of anartha nivritti. And yes, it's a thickening of faith. It's also based on practice and the mercy of Krishna. The way that this is mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam is in the progression of verses in the first canto, second chapter, beginning with Shushu Sho Shadadhanasya Vasudeva Kataruchi Syam Mahat Sevaya Vipra Puna Tirtana Shavanat. So this verse says that if you serve a devotee, you did a great thing. This is a great service. And by that, your taste for hearing about Krishna will awaken. Then, Shrinvatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hirtan Taksto Hibhadrani Fitunoti Suritsatam. As you hear and chant, Krishna helps you from within the heart to remove the obstacles. Nashta Prayishu Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. This verse is interesting because it's mentioning that your anarthas are removed by the process of hearing in association devotees practically to know. And the next verse then goes on to say that, describe the position in which Tada Rajastamo Bhava. At the time when all of the anarthas are gone, then you realize yourself in your relationship with Krishna. So there's a progression that happens as you practice, but one of the ways in which it happens is that Krishna notices that you're hearing and chanting, and he takes a personal interest in helping you. Of course, he always has a personal interest in helping us, but when we exert ourselves to listening to the pastimes of Krishna and the instructions of Krishna, then he especially helps us from within the heart. Kishore Shyam, please.
I'm glad you mentioned that verse from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that starts with Shraddha all the way up to Prema. I've been reading the Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati's Prakriti Rasa Sata Dushani, right? The development of rasa without mistaking it for being material rasa. Mm. There's 100 verses on this. And I'm a little confused. There seems to be almost a very clear, I'm confused about how porous is the divide between anartha nivritti to nishtha to ruchi. Does one have to completely have anartha nivritti before one gets nishtha and ruchi? Would it be bragging if one were to say that one has experienced ruchi without having complete anartha nivritti, I guess is my question. How complete is the process?
It's reasonable, and it's mentioned in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that sometimes these, and also in the Madhurya Kadambini, that sometimes one experiences samples of these things prematurely. Even in the nectar devotion, you'll notice in the section that Prabhupada mentions about attachment to pure devotees. If one gets association with a pure devotee, one can, through the moonshine that comes from the heart, the shining moon of the heart, of prema, of the heart of a pure devotee, one can start experiencing some advanced symptoms oneself. And there's also the case given for Narada Muni. And we notice in the first canto that Narada, although he wasn't qualified, he had an extraordinary experience where he got a very strong dose of ruchi in association with Krishna, and then he lost it. And then Krishna spoke to him and in an unembodied voice and said, "You're there, little sample, but you're not ready yet. So keep practicing." So yes, they can. One can experience these things out of turn, but the being actually situated in that properly is something that happens in progression.
If I may, elsewhere, Rupa Goswami mentions lobha in its relationship to ruchi. But then I note that on that particular list, lobha is not included, and neither is rati. Well, I tend to equate rati with bhava. I'm just a little confused on like maybe the positioning of lobha in terms of ruchi. And then am I right to be equating rati with bhava on that particular list?
Yeah, and those details are enumerated in the literatures, like the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and so forth. And one thing that we should know importantly is lobha comes after anartha niviti. In other words, that once we're freed from the dross of these particular obstacles to our devotional service, which are mentioned, the obstacles to coming to nishtha are actually start off with first is laya, which means sleep. It means that I have a tendency to sleep while I'm doing bhajan. Like I start my bhajan and then I think, you know, I'd rather go to sleep. Of course, if someone told me I won the lottery, I probably wouldn't be asleep. So the tendency to sleep is one of the obstacles. And then another one is distraction. And it means that while I'm doing my chanting, while I'm doing anything else, my mind jumps to some other thing. It's not fixated on the hearing and chanting. The real situation of pure devotional service, madguna shruti mathrina mai sarva guhashaye manogatir avichina yatadingam vasam budhau, that the mind is fixated on hearing about Krishna and pulled just like the water of the Ganges goes towards the ocean. And then there's a situation in which one's not distracted. There are no distractions, but one's just not interested. And then there's innate desires that I have. They're just there in my senses. There's kind of a contamination. Senses have that they're attracted to their objects naturally. And then there's certain qualities like lust, anger, and so forth that still reside within the heart. And these are mentioned as the great obstacles to attaining nishtha. But by the practice of devotional service and Krishna's help, when one goes through the great exercise of anartha niviti, then one comes to nishtha. And nishtha is actually defined as the absence of these obstacles. Then one begins to develop lobha, or intense greed for devotional service. And after all, what else are you going to do? If you don't have any preoccupation in the material world anymore, what else are you going to do except for devotional service? And the process of ruchi, as a very positive phase where
you know, you've been pushing the rock uphill and now it's starting to roll down the other side. It starts to go easily because you're actually interested in this. It's not like you're struggling to bring your mind back. Actually, in Ruchi, it's easy to bring your mind back to the topic of hearing about Krishna. And in, after Ruchi Asakti, where one's actually attached, then it's very difficult to bring one's mind back from all the other things one has to do. In other words, it's difficult to take one's mind away from the topic of Krishna and apply it to the rest of the things one has to do in the world. We see that in Uddhava, when Madhura starts to ask him questions, he has to wrest his mind away from Krishna's lotus feet in the spiritual world just to be fully present and conscious to be able to answer him. But the details and the nuances are mentioned in all these scriptures as help to us, so that as we refine our practice, we can start to notice these things, and we can examine our various motivations and the levels of taste that we're attaining or not, and that's very helpful to know the progressive path. Thanks for bringing those things up. Shredder has one here. Still can't tell what time it is, so. I mean, I can look at my watch, but I'm looking at that wheel. Can you tell what time it is by looking at that? What? By looking at that. I'm asking if you can look at that clock and tell me what time it is. No, I'm not asking what time it is. I'm asking if you can look at that clock and tell me. I really can't tell. It's very interesting. Okay, sorry I disturbed everybody. Go ahead, Shraddha.
I was saying there's one, we were discussing 1858, and there's another verse which is in complete alignment with 1858, and that's 12-16, that Krishna is defining the pure devotee.
12-16.
Bhagavad Gita 12-16.
And what are we looking at this verse for? What is it proving?
It's an alignment with 1858, verse. And what you have been saying.
Okay, here's an alignment verse. Anapeksha shutir daksha udasino gatavyata savarambha prityagi yomha bhakta samipriyaha. Translation is, my devotee who is not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, who is pure, expert, without cares, free from all pains, and not striving for some result, is very dear to me. Purport. Money may be offered to a devotee, but he should not struggle to acquire it. If automatically, by the grace of the Supreme, money comes to him, he is not agitated. Naturally, a devotee takes a bath at least twice in a day and rises early in the morning for devotional service. Thus, he is naturally clean, both inwardly and outwardly. A devotee is always expert because he fully knows the essence of all activities of life, and he is convinced of the authoritative scriptures. A devotee never takes the part of a particular party. Therefore, he is carefree. He is never pained because he is free from all designations. He knows that his body is a designation, so if there are some bodily pains, he is free. The pure devotee does not endeavor for anything which is against the principles of devotional service. For example, constructing a big building requires great energy, and a devotee does not take to such a business if it does not benefit him by advancing his devotional service. He may construct a temple for the Lord, and for that he may take all kinds of anxiety, but he does not construct a big house for his personal relations. Up to the top again, would you mind? Money is maybe offered to devotee, but he should not struggle to acquire it. It's just going back to Narada Muni's verse, where he says that things naturally come according to one's previous karma. And I just recently, I have a nephew, I think he's 49 years old, and he's intelligent, but he's really simple. He just retired because he could at 49, because he inherited
from both my sister, who had many, and his father, who recently died. So he lost his father and his mother recently, but they both had a lot of money. And but he's never really worked very hard at all. He's a librarian. And like I say, he's a simple person that really has never exerted himself very much, except for he's done his duty. He went to school, got a degree, and became a librarian. In an obscure part of a college library, he worked in the drama section. He knew a lot about drama, and, you know, the drama students would come in, he'd know which play was where. I mean, and he never really worried for money very much at all, and then he just suddenly became the wealthiest person in our family. He went out thinking about it much. And I was just noticing that, because I saw him recently, and I was thinking, like, well, it's interesting. It's like he never really tried. Others tried, and they really didn't get very far, but he didn't do anything. And he's just a simple librarian who's now retired and doesn't live ostentatiously either. It's kind of still a simple lifestyle. Doesn't even have a car. But things come, and they go. So devotees also, they realize this principle, and they're also, devotees consider themselves, just like Prabhupada would give the example, if you're a teller at a bank, all kinds of money comes in, and all kinds of money goes out. When it goes out, does he care? And when it comes in, he's also not disturbed. He just puts it in the right place. So devotees also realize that whatever I have, it's coming by Krishna's grace, and it's not mine, so I just take care of it. And if it goes out, that's fine too. It's up to Krishna. It makes his, I'm just watching over these things for him. And you had another point, please.
Actually, Narhari Dev Prabhu from Canada.
Really?
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, Narhari Dev Prabhu.
He says that it's kind of interesting how much one must do to actually maintain your position in the material world. Even the demons had to do 100 ashwamedh sacrifices to get to stay in the heavenly planets. Trying to remain Krishna conscious and engaging in devotional services is important while maintaining one's body in this material world.
Prabhupada points out, thank you for that point, he points out even more specifically this dichotomy. That is that it's really hard work to go to hell. And it's relatively easy to go back to Godhead. And he explains that in order to go to hell, you have to build roads, you have to maintain big buildings, you have to maintain slaughterhouses, a big stock exchange program. If you look at all the implements of the material civilization, they're very complicated. And bhakti, on the other hand, is simple, because Krishna says, offer me a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water. It's a sentiment that he accepts. Not that, of course, we shun any of the material facilities, or not that we're Luddites, but we understand that the extra engagement to acquire things, the struggle that is required to maintain a status quo in the material world, is futile, because there's already a certain amount that's allotted to us because of our previous activities and so forth, and one has to do one's duty dutifully, but depend on the result from Krishna. And if you want to go to hell, you really got to work at it. It's very hard work. Yes, Hansapriya.
Actually, in bhakti also is so easy until you get to the point, getting the direction from the right person. Because I was listening to Prabhupada's tape when I was laid off and I had already some financial obligations. And I hear Prabhupada say, I was filling out the job application, and I hear Prabhupada said that it is, you're like a prisoner. It's the warden's responsibility where you're going to get your cell, bed, and the food. So I just went straight to Krishna Balaram and I said, it's your responsibility how I'm going to get the job. And at that moment of relief that I felt was so much better than even getting a job. So I just wanted to share that in bhakti, if we get the proper direction, you know, that much, even if it's difficult, you have to maintain, but it becomes better.
Thank you. Very practical, something we can really relate to in our personal lives. Yes, Akeshri.
Prabhuji, this was connected to the earlier thing about Nishtha, Ruchi, in the stages. So I was just wondering that, you know, when I just got to Krishna consciousness, and I was told that, you know, anything that is material, you should not be doing. You have to do anything spiritual. So I was a very avid movie watcher. So as soon as I got to Krishna consciousness, I started chanting 16 rounds, and I totally gave up watching movies. And, you know, it was like almost for many years. And then, you know, I used to be an orchestra singer for Bollywood songs in my community. So I would remember all the songs, but it was all gone. You know, I was like, wow, I don't even have an attraction towards it anymore. Now, after 20 years, I feel I'm back to square one. Where, you know, somebody reminds me of that song, I just want to go back and listen to it. Or I want to sing the song because I had so much, because I love music. So, you know, I was just thinking that I just feel that after so much of sadhana, I'm coming back to the same square one.
Yeah, we might feel like that sometimes, square one, but there is no square one, because as one invests oneself in devotional service, whether we know or know not, there is a reservoir of experience, spiritual experience we have within us. And that will come to bear. Prabhupada mentions that in the light of the Bhagavat, that we are practicing devotional service, and just as when people are practicing chaturmasya and they stay in one place and perform austerities, they may then begin to take it for granted and think, oh, I'm just sitting in a room, what are we actually doing here? And he says something profound, that they may not realize the result of their practice until they actually leave that room after 4 months. And when they walk out and look at the world, they'll think, oh, I'm different. The world's different. I'm seeing it differently because of my contribution to these austerities. I'm not saying that we should perform those kinds of austerities. I'm just saying that this is a metaphor Prabhupada's using for our lives. Because then he goes on to say that our lives are a chaturmasya-like existence. Our lives are a chaturmasya-like existence. We're here for a short amount of time. We're performing our activities in devotional service. And then he says that we may not realize the full result of our bhakti practice until we leave the body. And when we do, then it will all come to bear. So you're not back to square one. However, there are challenges that come up at different times during our practice of bhakti, and those we have to deal with, because as you know from playing sports, probably, and you have to cross the finish line. You can't, you know, if there's 4 laps, you can't quit at number 3. And also when you're going across the finish line, they teach you to run past it, and because you don't want to just walk up to it or whatever. So we have to be vigilant coming into the last parts of our practice. And we also have to, at certain intervals, reinvest ourselves, realign ourselves. Because complacency can come in at any time. And we can also become distracted. By degrees, it's really easy to drift off. Just like you know, people are trying to maintain a certain weight in their life, so then they're very vigilant for a while. They measure how much they're eating and so forth, so that they don't become overweight. And then after a while, they get thin again, and then they're thinking, you know, I'm pretty good. I can have I'll have that cookie or whatever, and next thing you know, they'll have 2 cookies and then 10, and then a gallon of milk and 10 cookies before they go to bed. And then it's like, hey, how'd I get fat again? You know, and by degrees also, we can slip away from our devotional practice also. So we have to remember, you know, what our opportunity is, and that this is, that it all comes down to the end also. Ante narayana smriti. We have to remember what we're working for. When we leave this world, we have to be able to remember Krishna. There are various answers to that question, but you know, one of the simple ones is that we have to snap ourselves out of it every once in a while by good association and you know, rededicating ourselves. That's why the beginning of the year is a good time to start over again and look and see, you know, how am I doing? What have I slipped into by degrees and so forth? Yes.
Regarding what Sukeshwara said to me, I remember what you said in another class, like, you may feel like you're at the bottom of the hill all the time, but you're climbing a different hill because there are layers.
Yeah.
So, I also remember what Hanumat Prakshik Swami says, that the same tests will come again and again, it's like a spiralizer. You may go through the same instances, but even when you indulge, you will feel that you're more equipped because of all the Chaturmasya period, like practice that you just mentioned, that you will be able to combat with much higher knowledge, as you just said. So I was just thinking about that. Like, it may feel like we are still at the bottom, but it's a different hill at a higher elevation. Yeah.
Right. It's a nice example, very encouraging. When you're going to the Himalaya, traversing the foothills and they're going up and down, although you're rising in elevation, still it feels like there's ups and downs that may be there. Yes, Prabhu.
To your earlier point, when you mentioned that more of the person become advanced, as Prabhupada mentioned in your discussion, he told that they have to be very careful, they shouldn't start taking the process lightly. I just wanted to highlight one experience I had 2 years ago when my mother's spiritual master visited, actually, gracefully at home, and he's 90 plus, and he has thousands of followers. But when we offered him the prasadam to try the morning, and he gracefully declined, he said he hasn't yet finished his reading. I was stunned. I was in by the stunned. He's 94 actually. But he said, I haven't finished that. I'm going to finish it while I'm driving to the Haridwara on the way, and then I will eat. So I thought, like, to your point, those who are advanced, they don't take things lightly, their practice. So just thought to share.
Yeah, that was, I felt that one. That was good. Haridas Thakur also, when he became infirm, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told him, you have nothing to prove. You don't have to chant so many rounds now. Haridas Thakur said, basically, he said, I'd rather die than not finish my rounds. So if you could accommodate me, I'll just die, you know, now, while I can see you while I'm dying. So yeah, remembering the happiness of being strict. Entitlement is something Jamuna used to talk about, the famous disciple of Srila Prabhupada, who passed away a few years ago, but she mentioned frequently how, as one continues in the practice of devotional service and gains some status, one might then take advantage of it and consider oneself entitled, that now I don't have to be as strict, or now I deserve certain things. These kinds of things can come in over the long run. So you have to strategize how to not succumb to such temptations and stay simple and humble and hungry as you continue. So, is there any more from the internet? Oh yes, from over here in the pundit circle.
Question regarding, I have two questions. The first one is about status and result, because often, like, if I'll do something like service or anything, then I'll get to my head for the results. So how do you not get too much, like, how do you not go after the status and results when you're doing devotional service or just in bhakti in general?
Well, one thing is to think in a bigger way. And if you consider that your goal is to see that, for instance, say you're doing service at ISV, and if your goal is to see that ISV is successful, then you won't consider it as much, oh, how noticed for what I just did. I noticed this in book distribution, for instance. And there's, living entities are fiercely competitive. I've noticed this about living entities. And, you know, in the old days with book distribution, there was a way that I noticed even that it was hazardous. Devotees would be so involved in competing in book distribution that that's what they really cared about more than anything, is just winning. And even to the point where they would withhold information from others so that, you know, others wouldn't get an advantage. They'd win. So this is due to what they call in business of what is called bounded rationality, that you become so bound in your own tiny little context that you forget about the overall mission. So I noticed for myself that thinking in terms of the whole world should distribute books, you know, one global team, and then, okay, ISV is one part of it. Look at the microphone, that's really interesting. But if I'm focused on how ISKCON does globally, then I want everybody to excel. Well, as in North America, about 8 years ago, you know, we got together and said, let's work as one team and measure as one team and see how we do. Then we become more interested in like how everybody does, because we're thinking in a bigger way. That's one thing that is very practical. And the other thing is to realize that the only one who really notices everything that you do is Krishna. Other people, they may notice or not notice what you did. And also, more importantly, they may care or not care. If you're doing it to impress other people, sometimes if you do something extraordinary to impress other people, they may just get envious. And it may be counterproductive that you go, look what we did, you know. And people are like, yeah, well, we hate you now. We used to actually like you when you were the underdog, you know. Now that you're a big shot, you know, we don't even like you anymore. So there's not a lot of fruit in actually, you know, doing big and then showing everybody. But Krishna knows what you're doing, and he always brings it out in the right way that's healthy. So one can then conclude that it's a much better program just to do my service and offer it to Krishna and not worry about it. Let him deal with whatever remuneration or adoration or any distinction that comes from it. You know, let him implement that, and then devotees actually become averse to taking that. Like we saw from Madhavendra Puri, who became so famous because of his pure devotional service that the deity reciprocated with him when he thought, oh, I'd like to taste that for my deity. And then the deity stole some of the sweet rice and then told the pujari in a dream, go give it to Madhavendra Puri. And then he went and gave it to Madhavendra Puri, and Madhavendra Puri thought, uh-oh, this is going to get out. And people are going to come after me and my bhajan will be disturbed. So he just left. So you have to have some kind of an internal recognition that really I'm doing this for Krishna, and just leave it at that. I mean, there are some cases where recognition is necessary to hold things together. And that's a tricky thing. Prabhupada insisted that he be named the ISKCON founder Acharya. And, you know, and then people started, disciples who had been influenced by other colleagues of Prabhupada who were envious of his success. And then they started, for instance, one of the books came out, they published it, and they just put A.C. Bhaktivedanta. They didn't put the word Prabhupada. And Prabhupada started to notice little things that people had been influenced. his own disciples, and you know, once he recognized it, and he started talking to the devotees about it, and he was very disturbed, because it was necessary for him to be in the center of the organization and recognized as that. He knew that in order to hold it together. So his motive wasn't to be recognized that, oh, I want to be known as the founder of Charya for self-aggrandizement, but because he knew every organization has to have a clear acharya, otherwise it will fall apart because people will drift in different directions if it's not clearly established. So the motive has to be correct. But for our purposes, in most cases, we can really just surrender the result of what we're doing to Krishna and let him deal with it and let it come out that way. Does that help?
Yes.
And you have another one.
My second question, I think I found the answer, but the question is that in the teachings of Kum Kunti, in one of the purports, Srila Prabhupada mentions that Krishna actually wants us to go back home, back to Godhead with him, more than we want to ourselves. But my question is just saying, why were we put in this material world in the first place? Because he has like the potency to change our opinions and like how we feel and how we feel about coming to the material world. But I think the answer was because since we're individual souls and we have freedom, so he like kind of let us come.
That is the answer. We're not dead stones, and the whole point of the relationship between Krishna and ourselves is love. And there is no love without freedom. In fact, you'll notice that Krishna goes to great lengths to give us freedom on the material side too. Why 8,400,000 species of life? Why not just 5? Because someone might claim, you know, like, well, you really didn't give me a fair shot at the material world. But after 8,400,000 species of life, you know, no one can say, like, you didn't try. You didn't give me facility to try to every single thing. I mean, you look at these living entities. I was near the ocean recently, and I was just looking. I was like, where'd you come from? You're really strange, you know. And it's like Krishna is like, you try everything. And if there wasn't an alternative world that with unlimited facility to try all kinds of things, where's the freedom of choice? And that's really the theme of Krishna's entire creation, material and spiritual, that the living entities have the free choice to take it or leave it. We are of the same quality as Krishna. Different quantity, but same quality. It means we're little controllers also. And we also have the same kind of free will Krishna has, but just not unlimitedly. So we tend to get caught in little eddies and whirlpools because of our misuse of independence. The ultimate answer to that question of how we came to the material world is something that Krishna knows. And that we can know when we're in Chit Samadhi. And the endless pursuit of answering that question on an intellectual level is just that, an endless pursuit that goes on here, there, and everywhere, but you don't see it endlessly pursued in the Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavad Gita, or anywhere else. Thank you. Very provocative and interesting questions. Okay, so we're going to have a Guru Puja now. So we're going to move the asanas away, and we're going to say some prayers, and then sing the Guru Vashtakam to Srila Prabhupada. Gopremanande Haribo Vanchakalpudibhuscha Kripasindabe Vichapatitanam Bhavanibyo Vaishnabe Bhyo Namo Namaha Anantakodi Vaishnabe Nikijaya.
Natchariyar Marman. Hey! Natchariyar Marman. Natchariyar Marman. Natchariyar Marman.